Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, How Safe is Your Surgeon? Medicare Data Reveals Complication Rates for Triangle Area Physicians. And that's on the cover. The actual article begins inside with a second headline, It's report card time for surgeons. Data from Medicare on common procedures reveal range of complication rates among Triangle doctors. And this article is written by Jason DeBruin. Competition for patients, regulatory oversight, insurance challenges, and increased financial pressures are among the reasons hospital executives throughout the Triangle are spending more time than ever making sure the physicians under their watch perform up to accepted medical standards. Primarily through established peer review processes, hospital administrators look for warning signs of doctors and surgeons who carry with them a higher risk of complications, readmissions, or other negative outcomes. Now, thanks to data made available from Medicare, patients can run similar checks on their surgeons before they go under the knife for common procedures like knee replacements, gallbladder removal, or prostate surgery. Using Medicare claims data, and with the help of investigative nonprofit organization ProPublica, Triangle Business Journal analyzed outcomes from common surgeries to see if any Triangle area surgeons show a higher rate of complications. The data show that while the Triangle is a relatively safe place to have an operation, some surgeons have better performance records than others. Doctors under scrutiny. For many years, medical error was not broadly discussed, but a landmark research report titled To Err is Human, published in 1999 by the Institute of Medicine, found that more than half of all adverse events were preventable and estimated that some 98,000 deaths per year could be attributed to medical error. In 2013, a report published by the Journal of Patient Safety increased those estimates significantly, reporting that, quote, a lower limit of 210,000 deaths per year was associated with preventable harm in hospitals, unquote. On the high end, the group estimated that preventable harm might be to blame for as many as 400,000 deaths per year. The epidemic of patient harm in hospitals must be taken more seriously if it is to be curtailed. Fully engaging patients and their advocates during hospital care, systematically seeking the patient's voice in identifying harms, transparent accountability for harm, and intentional correction of root causes of harm will be necessary to accomplish this goal, the report concludes. Using the data. In looking at the surgeon safety data, Triangle hospital executives caution that the scores aren't conclusive, but they can serve as a starting point for patients to ask questions. When you look at physician data, it's really in its infancy, says Dr. Linda Butler, Chief Medical Officer of UNC Rex Healthcare, the Raleigh hospital affiliated with UNC Healthcare. Dr. West Paul, WakeMed Vice President of Quality and Patient Safety, holds a similar view. It's a good first step. You've got to start somewhere. Is this the right place to go? I don't know, he says. Indeed, the data has limitations. The information comes from a federal program which takes time to aggregate, and it includes data only from a subset of Medicare patients. Risk factors were assessed based on claims data. For example, if patients required any follow-up care that was billed, but that can exclude nuances. Even a good procedure can have a bad outcome. Still, ProPublica went about the analysis in a complete way. It excluded trauma and other high-risk procedures that are more likely to result in complications that are beyond a surgeon's control, and adjusted for factors like diabetes or obesity. It also received input from 24 physicians to help keep the grading system fair. In the Triangle, as across the state and nation, the vast majority of surgeons score within a low or medium risk factor range, with only a few outliers scoring higher complication rates. Those findings don't come as a surprise when juxtaposed to a recent long-term study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which found that just 1% of all doctors accounted for 32% of all paid malpractice claims, and 94% of doctors had no claims at all. Doctors who accumulate multiple claims are a problem and a threat to the healthcare system. Identifying these high-risk doctors is a key first step toward doing something about the problem, said study leader, author David Studdard, a professor of law and medicine at Stanford University. And this article also includes a long list of the doctors with their scores. Too long for us to list, but each hospital has very similar scores. We'll read some of the quotes also mixed in from some of the people at the hospital, like Dr. Westpaul, WakeMed Vice President of Quality and Patient Safety. This is probably the first time the conversation is starting. As imperfect as it may be, that patient's primary care physician will know more than the data can show, at least at this time. If the relationship is good with the patient, they will be very frank, and they will not send their patient to someone who they know is not a good surgeon. Dr. Linda Butler, Chief Medical Officer of UNC Rex Healthcare. We now have the patient at the center, and we need the patient to be actively engaged in their own health, and part of that is choosing the healthcare provider that meets their needs best. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. Meet the State Club's new GM and chef. The State Club at the Park Alumni Center on NC State University's Centennial Campus has a new general manager and an executive chef. Chris O'Leary, former food and beverage manager at Club Corps, is the new general manager, and Jerry Fong, winner of the Food Network's 2014 season of Cutthroat Kitchen, is the new chef. O'Leary, most recently, was food and beverage director of the Cardinal Club and Devil's Ridge Golf Club through his employment with Club Corps. Before that, he was banquet manager of Prestonwood Country Club. Fong is a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America and grew up working alongside his parents in their Chinese restaurants in Laurinburg. He was the winner of the Fire on the Dock competition dining in 2013. We are excited to have Chris O'Leary join our team as general manager to help us provide the highest level of guest services at the State Club, says Daniel Adams, NCSU's Associate Vice Chancellor for Campus Enterprises, which oversees campus retail and hospitality operations. Executive Chef Jerry Fong, well known for his exciting approach to culinary innovation, will lead the kitchen team, he says. Another new announcement: while dinner and special events are exclusive to its more than 400 members, the State Club restaurant is now open to the public for lunch on weekdays from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Chavis, let's all dig a little deeper. It was quite an inspiring luncheon Biz attended on February 8 to witness a frank conversation among three individuals reflecting on some dark days in North Carolina's history. The event, put together by PNC Financial to celebrate Black History Month, was spearheaded by Benjamin Chavis Jr., the African-American civil rights leader born in Oxford. In his youth, Chavis was an assistant to Martin Luther King Jr. In 1972, Chavis became internationally known as the leader of the Wilmington Ten, civil rights activists who were charged with committing arson and subsequently received a prison sentence of 34 years. Thankfully, in 1980, a federal appeals court overturned the convictions of the group, citing prosecutorial misconduct. Chavis discussed various topics during the luncheon with fellow panelist Cash Michaels, who produced a documentary on the Wilmington Ten, and Irving Joyner, a law professor at NC Central University. Asking the attendees to learn and reflect on the changes since the Wilmington Ten days, Chavis said, "You want to celebrate Black History Month? Make more history," adding, "North Carolina has a deep history, and we all need to dig a little deeper." Well said, Dr. Chavis. Triangle Wine Experience, great wine, great company, great cause. The 23rd annual Triangle Wine Experience took place February 4 through 6, culminating with an extravagant wine gala in an abandoned warehouse just off NC Highway 55 in South Durham. The event, which raises money for the Frankie Lemina Foundation, was a who's who of Triangle luminaries. Seen mingling in the crowd were the Avett Brothers cellist Joe Kwan, North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper, former Glaxo Welcome executive Bob Ingram, Bland Landscaping owner Kurt Bland, as well as Raleigh Restaurateur and TBJ's 2014 Business Person of the Year, Ashley Christensen, Triangle Wine Experience chairwoman Eliza Kraft Olander was extremely moved when her son, Michael Olander Jr., received the Boots Mims Award at the gala. "This is all about bringing up another generation to keep the fires going, to teach your children well. It goes for everyone and anyone," says Eliza. The donors and sponsors are far too many to list, but she praised them all. "I absolutely love it when I see the light in their eyes when they get it," she says, "when they realize why they are here donating. That is an absolute joy to see, and I never get tired of it." And in a section called Celebrity Corner, baseball legend Cal Ripken Jr. with Raleigh Mayor Nancy McFarlane at the recent U.S. Conference of Mayors winter meeting in San Francisco. Ripken spoke about Mayors Play Ball, a joint initiative of Major League Baseball and the Mayors Group to strengthen the connection between baseball and American communities, especially urban and underserved areas. And finally, in a section called They Said It, the first quote, "If you look at my publicly available calendar, you'll find I have meetings with Duke all the time." That's from Donald Vander Vaart, Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, in a recent visit to Triangle Business Journal. Governor Pat McCrory and his staff have faced criticism in recent months over private meetings with Duke Energy executives. Vander Vaart called the controversy a great example of a non-issue. The next quote, "We've been watching the blogs and what people are saying about the project, of course, and I'll never forget reading one of the comments about how so many people have tried to get projects done in Durham and just couldn't get it done. It resonated with me. I didn't want to be one of those people who came up short. I wanted to be the person to get the ball across the goal line." And that's from Greg Hills, Colorado real estate developer, who helped dream up the 27-story One City Center Tower building that will be under construction soon in downtown Durham. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page, written by Jason DeBruin. The first headline, BioCryst CEO disappointed after stock plummets, says opportunities remain. Durham-based BioCryst Pharmaceuticals saw some $320 million shaved off its market value on February 8 when the drug developer announced that its experimental drug, called Avoralstat, did not show better results than a placebo. BioCryst's share price dropped 70% on February 8, the Monday after the Super Bowl, but company executives stayed positive, saying they would regroup in an effort to get better trial results in the future. "While we're disappointed with this result, we're moving on," BioCryst CEO John Stonehouse said. BioCryst is developing a treatment for hereditary angioedema, a disorder that causes swelling in various body parts, including the hands, feet, face, and airway. The condition is rare in that it affects fewer than 1 in 50,000 people, and far fewer by some estimates, but can be debilitating or even fatal. There is still room on the horizon for good news, however. As of September 30, the company had $47 million in cash and equivalents and another $30 million in investments and receivables. The company is generating revenue from an antiviral treatment for the flu called Rapivab. Also, it is expecting results from another trial in the middle part of this year. In this other trial, patients had higher exposure levels to the drug. "We just didn't put enough gas in the tank," said BioCryst Chief Medical Officer Bill Sheridan. Transenterix to seek $44 million from public markets. Research Triangle Park-based surgical robot developer Transenterix will look to raise as much as $44 million from the public markets in the coming months. The company reported it raised $18 million in net proceeds in the past year and will look to raise the additional capital at any time in the coming year. Separately, but at the same time, Transenterix announced that it completed its response to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in regards to a pending application for clearance of its SurgiBot system surgical robot. FDA must give clearance before Transenterix may commercially market the robot that's designed to help surgeons. To raise additional funds, Transenterix will sell shares through a process called an at-the-market or ATM facility. Instead of selling a fixed number of shares at a fixed price, it will sell shares in a more fluid way in the coming months, selling shares at the price of the market at the time, hence the name. This will, of course, dilute existing shareholders, and the share price dipped 5% February 10. However, the closing price of $4.19 is still more than double the $1.74 closing price on January 25. So the slight dip could be attributed to a short-term investor's cashing in a profit. Transenterix shares have not traded this high since early June. And in a section called On the Move, Durham-based drug developer Novan named Triangle Pharma titan Robert Ingram as chairman of its board of directors. Ingram, former CEO and chairman of GlaxoWelcome, was already a member of the drug developer's board. And in a section called She Said It, the quote is, "This will be a definitive clinical trial that will help set the course for future DCIS treatment. It is based on what we are discovering about the tremendous variety we see even in one disease such as DCIS and how we must design our future treatments to more precisely reflect those differences." And that's from Dr. E. Shelley Huang, Chief of Breast Surgery at the Duke Cancer Institute and the principal investigator of a study to learn more about how to treat women with very early signs of breast cancer, an issue of no small debate in the oncology world. Duke will share in a $13.4 million award for the study. And finally, in a section called Big Numbers, $1.63 million. The amount of grants and loans from the North Carolina Biotechnology Center to North Carolina life sciences companies in the second quarter of the 2015 to 2016 fiscal year. The North Carolina Biotech Center awards funding for life sciences companies as an economic driver in that industry. The figure for the second quarter was nearly double in the awards from the first quarter. And 165,645, the number of people in the Greater Triangle who selected or were automatically enrolled in an Affordable Care Act marketplace health insurance plan during the current enrollment period. Statewide, 613,487 people in North Carolina signed up for 2016 coverage through healthcare.gov, a 10% increase from 2015. And now we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, new NCIDS CEO hails from Kauffman. It was empty nester syndrome that coaxed entrepreneurial activist Tom Rue from Ohio to the Triangle. While he technically starts his CEO tenure at NCIDS in March, Rue is in Durham this month, both for an NCIDS board meeting and to scout out what will soon be his new home. While he's still picking between the metros, "I'll probably just lease a place at first," he says. He's pretty familiar with the Triangle. That's because as Vice President of Entrepreneurship at the Kauffman Foundation, Rue and his team helped tell the Triangle story through digital magazine ID8 Nation. For a story package released in 2014, ID8 Nation told the story of the Research Triangle region's effort to become one of the top five entrepreneurial hotspots in the country. Research Triangle Park not only has a vibrant startup community to model, it is facing some challenges that other cities also might relate to, said Rue at the time. It's that combination that makes the region so rich with lessons and so relevant to other communities. We hope this compelling coverage sparks a conversation within the Triangle and beyond. It's a narrative that stuck with him over the following months, and a conversation with a friend, Ted Zoller, director of the UNC Center for Entrepreneurial Studies, led to NC Idea. I had mentioned to him we were soon going to be empty nesters, he says, so Zoller mentioned NC Idea, and Rue jumped at the chance. It's an exciting opportunity, he says. How CSX plans to meet safety rules. Seven train companies across the United States indicate they won't be making an already extended federal deadline to install a complicated safety system aimed at preventing derailments and collisions. Of the seven, two, Norfolk Southern and CSX, operate in North Carolina. While NCDOT Rail Division Director Paul Worley says the GPS system is a huge undertaking, he compares it to inventing Google Maps. The railroads do say they'll have an operational system in place by 2020. According to Caitlin Say, spokeswoman for Jacksonville, Florida-based CSX Corporation, here's what CSX has to do between now and then. Conduct a complete airborne laser imaging survey of CSX's 21,000-mile network. Install 4,600 wayside units. Replace signals along 7,500 miles of track. Install 1,285 radio base stations. Equip 3,200 locomotives. Train about 19,000 employees. And spend about $2.2 billion to deploy the system. And in a section called M&A Corner, Amatech, we want to grow ESP Surgex internationally. Amatech's buy of Knightdale technology firm ESP Surgex for $130 million means a global opportunity. That's according to James McKinley, spokesman for Amatech, speaking shortly after the deal announcement. He says the goal is to build on ESP Surgex's strong U.S. presence, expanding the unit's global reach through Amatech's existing international supply chain network. We're not an investment company, he said. We operate these businesses for the long haul. And in a section called Emerging Issues Forum, in pushing for job skills, don't forget liberal arts. The key to overcoming the skills gap could be a liberal arts education, according to a panel at the 31st Annual Emerging Issues Forum on February 8. Technology is shortening the shelf life for many skills, says John Cecil, chair of the Institute of Emerging Issues Forum and president of Biltmore Farms. He says that professionals across the spectrum have to update their knowledge base constantly. And the panelists, Mary Grant, chancellor of UNC Asheville, and John Scavarla, secretary of the North Carolina Commerce Department, agree, saying a liberal arts education helps in developing a lifelong learning attitude. Overheard at the Institute of Emerging Issues Forum panel on North Carolina's strategy to ensure future prosperity, in a section called They Said It. Liberal arts is the education that levels the playing field and creates the best opportunity. This is a modern convergence where we argue about it. We need both. We need the scientific inquiry. We need all of it. And that was from Grant. All of these are first names, last names of Mary Grant, John Cecil, or John Scavarla. I think the real discussion is not diversity, but inclusion, according to John Cecil. And he also says, if you can't communicate, it's basically worthless. And John Scavarla says, we need to be good listeners. At the end of the day, we are a needs-driven organization, and we need to respond to the needs employers have. We need to be entrepreneurial. He also said, our opportunity is limited only by our mind's eye. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate section, written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, Triangle Town Center to reboot following $174 million sale. For a good bit of the past 2 years, the owners, tenants, and shoppers of Triangle Town Center Mall in North Raleigh have been living under a cloud of uncertainty as a very expensive deadline approached in regards to a $171 million loan coming due at the end of 2015. CBL and Associates Properties, a major owner of mall properties across the country, wanted to keep Triangle Town Center in its portfolio, a 1.26 million square foot regional mall anchored by North Carolina's only Saks Fifth Avenue high-end department store. However, CBL's 50-50 joint venture partner and original developer of the Raleigh Mall, the Richard E. Jacobs Group, was ready to cash out and move on. After months of back-and-forth negotiations and a threat by CBL's executives to let the property loan go into default and possible foreclosure, the company announced on February 8 that it had reached a deal to both refinance the $171 million loan and sell a 90% ownership in the mall to a new private equity owner, New York-based DRA Advisors, for $174 million. CBL has retained a 10% ownership stake in the mall and will retain leasing and management duties. Andrew Peltz, managing director of DRA Advisors, in the news release issued by CBL, noted that the Triangle Town Center property can still become a dominant retail destination in Raleigh. "We too are excited about unlocking the potential of Triangle Town Center and are prepared to invest fresh vision and capital to bring the asset to a new level," Peltz stated. "This property is ideally situated to capitalize on the path of growth within metropolitan Raleigh, and we look forward to working with CBL to position Triangle Town Center as one of Raleigh's dominant retail destinations." The mall's total tenant occupancy level at the end of the fourth quarter was around 96%, with the majority of its vacancy centered in its outdoor commons area. With this new cash infusion, sources say mall officials are already in talks with several interested entertainment and restaurant tenants, including movie theater operators, to fill much of the vacant space within the next year or two. Neither Peltz nor CBL President and CEO Stephen Leibovitz disclosed how much additional capital the groups would be investing in marketing and improvements on the mall property, but sources say the investment is significant. Pittsburgh firm picks downtown Raleigh for new headquarters. Cohera Medical Incorporated, a rapidly growing medical device company that makes adhesives used in tummy tuck procedures, will soon be uprooting its headquarters in Pittsburgh and relocating to downtown Raleigh. Cohera Medical has signed a deal for a 16,000-square-foot office lease at the 227 Fayetteville office building in the heart of downtown Raleigh, according to sources at the Cushman & Wakefield commercial real estate firm. Cohera Medical President and CEO Patrick Daly has already bought a home in Raleigh and is expecting about 70% of his existing staff in Pittsburgh to follow him to the new Raleigh location. The company also plans to hire another 30 people in Raleigh over the next 18 months, which will more than double its workforce. "We chose Raleigh because it is a top destination for medical device and biotech companies and because we forecast more growth for the company," Daly stated in a news release. Cohera Medical will not be receiving any special economic development incentives from either the county, city, or state, since Cohera's executives had already finalized a relocation plan before contacting local officials, says Adrian Cole, executive director of Wake County Economic Development. "This area is getting more and more on the radar of executives who are hearing about it from either their own networks or through some of our own public relations efforts," Cole says. "We're busy right now with a lot of solid, active companies looking in our area." What luxury and exotic cars are wealthy North Carolina drivers buying? Sales of new cars and trucks in North Carolina outpaced the national growth average in 2015, with a 9% increase in all new vehicle sales and registrations compared to a 5.7% increase nationwide. And of the 491,000 821 new car and truck registrations in 2015, about 5.6% would be classified as the top luxury brands. That's up from 5.3% market share in 2013, according to an analysis of North Carolina Automobile Dealers Association's new car and truck registration report. Here's a sampling of what the wealthy are buying. Auto brand Tesla, base model purchase price, $70,000. Total sales in 2014, 160. Total sales in 2015, 274. That's a 71.3% difference. Porsche, $84,300. With a 6% difference, going from total sales in 2014 of 835 to total sales in 2015 of 885. Aston Martin, $103,300. Total sales, 18 for 2014. Total sales in 2015, 21, a 16.7% increase. And finally, Bentley, $198,500. Total sales, 26 in 2014. Total sales, 20 in 2015. And that percent difference was minus 23.1%. Highway contractor walks off the job at four projects. Devere Construction, a Michigan-based general contractor with a Raleigh office that's been working on highway construction projects across the state, has demobilized all of its workers and equipment pending a new agreement with the North Carolina Department of Transportation. Richard Crittenden, Devere's president, said in a news release that the work was stopped pending resolution of sizable claims for work already completed that he claims is being withheld from the company. He would not say how much money Devere is owed. The company had pending work projects in Charlotte, Jackson County, and Buncombe County, including a $52 million project to widen Independence Boulevard in Charlotte. But NCDOT spokesman Steve Abbott says that as of February 8, Devere is in default of its contract. As such, the state will require Devere's bonding company, Liberty Mutual, to arrange for completion of the projects. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal. And first we'll start with letters to the editor. The first one, headlined, Spirit Will Pay If Jobs Promise Goes Unfulfilled. And this is a letter from Dan Gerlach, president of the Golden Leaf Foundation. Your recent article on Spirit AeroSystems leaves the reader with the mistaken impression that the clawbacks to the Golden Leaf Foundation as a result of its capital and investment in the Global Transpark are completed. Golden Leaf provided funds to the Global Transpark Authority for a facility that Spirit AeroSystems currently uses. Spirit does not own, nor will it ever own, the facility, but had to make significant capital improvements to the facility as a requirement of its use. Moreover, the article references an April 2015 clawback payment made by Spirit due to failure to meet job creation requirements. The article reads that the Golden Leaf, quote, did receive a lump sum payment in April 2015 to satisfy those lease requirements, unquote. This indicates that the company's obligation is satisfied. It is not. Clawback payments are required annually by the foundation for failure to meet job creation requirements that have increased over time. Failure to meet the final job creation targets would result in ongoing clawback payments through the remainder of the lease term in 2030. It is our hope that Spirit is able to hire more Eastern North Carolinians to work in this advanced manufacturing facility, but if the company cannot, there are ongoing financial consequences to protect the investment. And another letter to the editor article, written by Bruce Kirchenbaum of Raleigh, headlined, Need to Tone Down North Hills' Rampant Growth. The continued development of North Hills, as you recently described in your issue, is nothing short of outrageous. That entire block, several, area, already is a major traffic bottleneck. With this new development, it will become one of the worst traffic areas in the entire region. Once again, elected officials have done nothing to deal with transportation issues while allowing rampant development. And now there's also a longer column on the Viewpoint page. The headline, Lawmakers Must Stabilize NIH Funding for Our Companies. And this is written by Charles A. Hayes, President and CEO of the Research Triangle Regional Partnership. We in the Research Triangle region of North Carolina often take for granted the enormous economic impact of our homegrown, market-leading companies like SAS and Quintiles. Each spun out of federally funded research discoveries at one of our universities, and each now creates thousands of jobs, pushes the envelope in life sciences and technology, and gives back in significant ways to the institutions and communities that helped create them. The cycle of innovation that created these companies and many others, large and small, has become commonplace, and it has made ours one of the most prosperous, globally competitive regions in the world. But it has not happened by accident. Decades ago, our leaders made a strategic choice to leverage the knowledge assets of our universities to create Research Triangle Park public and private investments in research and development, since that time have helped create a regional ecosystem in which innovation thrives. You know the result. Our region now boasts world-leading clusters in information technology, life sciences, clean tech, and other high-growth sectors that fuel a virtuous cycle of innovation. Thousands of scientific discoveries, commercialized by entrepreneurs and innovative businesses, spark company formation and growth, create good jobs for our citizens, secure strong tax bases for our communities, and produce products and services that improve the quality of life for our region, our state, and our world. Our leaders once again face a strategic choice and a key opportunity to ensure the region's innovation ecosystem continues to thrive by ensuring that one of our most important knowledge creation assets, the National Institutes of Health, receives increased and mandatory funding for medical research long term. NIH is the largest public funder of biomedical research in the world, investing more than $30 billion each year to enhance health, lengthen life, and reduce illness and disability. NIH investments are a major economic driver for our region and the state. NIH awarded $992 million to scientists in North Carolina in 2014, supporting more than 19,000 jobs and $2.4 billion in economic impact. Five states receive more funding from NIH. The lion's share of NIH's awards in North Carolina go to scientists in our region, $890 million, with the vast majority of those awarded to university researchers, $765 million, and the balance to private and nonprofit organizations. But NIH funding is in danger. Its budget has declined 22% in real terms during the past decade from budget cuts, sequestration, and inflation. And NIH funding must pass congressional muster every year. Decreased NIH funding means less fuel for discoveries and economic growth. Uncertain funding year to year makes it difficult for scientists to plan ahead and hampers their ability to secure additional investment for their work. Bipartisan support for NIH now exists in Congress, providing a prime opportunity for getting NIH funding back on track. The U.S. House of Representatives last year passed the 21st Century Cures Bill on a bipartisan vote that calls on the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to speed the approval process for new drugs and boost NIH funding for research. Importantly, the House bill calls for NIH's funding to be in the form of mandatory spending, which means it will be guaranteed over a number of years and not subject to the annual appropriations process. The Senate Health Committee is now developing its own version of a medical innovation bill that will address NIH funding. Medical researchers need a strong, growing, and reliable funding stream to continue moving the needle on life-saving discoveries. We need those discoveries to fuel our economy. North Carolina's senior senator, U.S. Senator Richard Burr, Republican North Carolina, has been a strong proponent and advocate of NIH funding, and we applaud his leadership in this area. We urge Senator Burr and all of our congressional leaders to take this opportunity to secure increased and mandatory funding for the NIH. And on the People on the Move page in the Triangle Business Journal, the spotlight is on C. Matthew Keene, managing shareholder at Ogletree Deacons. Since its founding nearly 40 years ago, the law firm of Ogletree Deacons, Nash, Smoke, and Stewart PC has had only three people hold the title of managing shareholder. Matthew Keene is now the fourth. Keene, who is based in the Ogletree Deacons Raleigh office, is now responsible for setting its strategic direction and managing the entire operations of the firm. He has practiced with Ogletree since graduating from law school in 1987, and in recent years he's become more involved in the business side of the firm, joining its board of directors in 2010 and becoming one of two managing directors in 2014. Ogletree Deacons has nearly 1,700 employees firm-wide across 40 offices, including more than 750 attorneys. There are more than 125 employees in its Raleigh office, about 30 of whom are practicing attorneys. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? The level of collaboration and teamwork that exists among our 49 offices. The secret to our growth has been our focus on providing exceptional client service to clients for their labor and employment law needs, whenever those needs may arise. This would not be possible without the one-team culture. Also, the strong relationships you can develop with clients. Many of my clients have become close personal friends, in addition to our professional relationship. This creates a level of trust and direct communication that strengthens the representation we provide. What are some of your major goals for your new position? Our goal is to be the premier global labor and employment law firm. We made a major step last month by opening an office in Toronto. My goal is to ensure that we maintain the responsiveness and client service that have made us successful, and to continue to develop the use of technology and knowledge management to provide greater value to our clients. Biggest pet peeve? People who are late. Biggest worry? As a lawyer, it is my job to worry about and find solutions for issues faced by clients. Triangle area business person that you most admire? Chancellor Randy Woodson has done an excellent job leading NC State University. Personal, wife Ruth, son Charles. And now we turn to a section in the Triangle Business Journal called The List. The headline, Anatomy of a Game, Concept to Box. Triangle Business Journal set out to understand what it takes to get a title from just an idea to a playable game. We recently caught up with John O'Neill, co-founder and president of Cary-based Spark Plug Games, to see how his company took one of its games through that process. Sparkplug is a small, independent development shop founded in 2008 and employs a little more than 20 people. Since its inception, the company has developed just shy of 60 titles, the majority of them being dubbed as serious games, ones used for educational and/or training purposes. But some of Sparkplug's titles are in the pure entertainment category, such as its latest, Mech Runner. O'Neill and his staff are currently in the process of taking Mech Runner into the next phase. Check out a behind-the-scenes look at the game, how it got its current phase, and how O'Neill plans to take it further. Step 1. Identify your concept and identify your audience. The idea that O'Neill and another company executive envisioned originated from what O'Neill calls a back-to-basics transforming robot game. It's an action game that casts the player as a mode-changing mech in battles against a robotic army. Step 2. Build on your relationships with contacts in the industry. O'Neill reached out to a number of his industry contacts outside of the company to get a feel for the viability of the game that would eventually become Mech Runner. One of these was a concept artist that has done work for Marvel and director and producer Michael Bay. After discussing it with his contact, O'Neill and his team decide this could be a real consumer product. Step 3. Find partners and build a development team. The Sparkplug Games team met with Sony to discuss early sketches of MechRunner and to present a short informational movie on the game. The biggest thing is not losing your intellectual property, O'Neill says. After Sony joined as a marketing partner, SPG then went to work gathering up a development team for the game, including designers, voice actors, etc. Step 4. Build the game, build the brand. SPG used the Unity Engine, a multi-platform game development tool used to develop video games, to develop MechRunner. Simply put, Unity Engine was used to save time on the more tedious things such as graphical subsystems, graphic inputs, and the like. Unity provided some of the early funding for the game's development back when it had a publishing division. Other funding came from revenue from SPG's previous titles and a Kickstarter campaign to help the studio add some finishing touches to the game. Step 5. Launch the game. Sony's partnership with SPG is intended to push the launch of its upcoming release on the PlayStation 4 console. Sony has since promoted the game through GameStop, trade shows, etc., O'Neill says. MechRunner is currently available for PC play on the entertainment platform Steam. O'Neill is hoping to launch the game on the PS4 and PlayStation Vita consoles in the first quarter of 2016. And below that information, there's another bit of information titled The Future of Game Development. Triangle Game Development Leaders offer their thoughts on the short-term future of the gaming industry. And first we have a quote from Keith Shepard, co-founder of Imanji Studios. What will the future of game development look like in 5 years, he's asked. I'm excited about the future of gaming and look forward to continued opportunities in social, mobile, and free-to-play. Outside of our core business, I'm looking forward to augmented reality and virtual reality developing into more mature platforms. It feels like we are on the cusp of something revolutionary and new in those fields. I look forward to seeing what kind of new experiences we'll be able to create as game designers. And there was a question posed to Josh Fairhurst, co-founder of Mighty Rabbit Studios. The question, where do you see the future of game development 5 years from now? The future of the game development will look a little different. A lot of smaller developers are going to go under due to increasing competition, but every time one of those developers closes, a new hobbyist or indie will take their place. Mid-tier developers are going to have to innovate and come up with new ways to create cash flow if they want to survive. And now we turn to the small business section in the Triangle Business Journal, where the main headline, How I Ditched My Global Corporate Career to Launch a Sports Facility Management Business. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun. And it's a profile of John Stock, CEO of Recreation Factory Partners. As a younger man, John Stock never thought of himself as a small business owner. The jobs he held early in his career didn't exactly scream entrepreneur. Equipped with a business degree, Stock spent a decade with PricewaterhouseCoopers, then became the acquisition director for Nabisco, and chief financial officer for Canada-based EMCO Distribution Group, a $1.5 billion corporation. That job led him from Canada to Kerry, where he became the CEO of EMCO Wheaton. My family and I were certainly becoming accustomed to change and transformation, he says. That company ultimately merged with one from the United Kingdom, and instead of relocating to the Northeast, Stock took a generous package to leave the company but stay in the Triangle. We had 3 middle and high school-aged children and did not want to uproot them again, he says. It was a turning point for Stock. I suppose the more difficult personal reinventing started then to leave traditional large corporate life to become small business entrepreneurs, he recalls. Stock had been part of a group named Ice Ventures, a group that passively invested in the Cary Ice House and believed there existed potential to build a regional sport and recreation entity. So they then built a Garner facility, acquired three ice rinks in Charlotte and Greensboro, built a new rink in Wilmington, and acquired the business operations of a soccer and inline facility in Cary. Then he formed Recreation Factory Partners, which built the flagship operation, the 200,000-square-foot sports factory in Wake Forest. At its peak, Recreation Factory Partners and its sister company, Ice Ventures, had 12 locations and $20 million in annual revenue. Over the past decade, various groups approached Stock to purchase the facilities not in the Triangle, and he sold them off one at a time. Then, New York-based Polar Ice Company acquired the Cary, Garner, and Wake Forest facilities. Separately, but at the same time, the Orange County Sportsplex was being managed by a nonprofit entity, but had average annual losses approaching $1 million. Stock took over that management contract. He had no ownership interest in the facility, and helped turn the Sportsplex into a profitable enterprise. He credits his wife, Brenda Stock, with helping make the Sportsplex profitable. When she first joined us to lead the effort to turn the Cary Ice House from a losing operation to one of the most profitable single-sheet ice rinks in the country, she became a permanent fixture in the business, he says. She was then instrumental in growing the sports factory. Although she has no formal business training, Stock says she has some of the most business common sense of anyone I've encountered, and taught herself skills in finance and accounting. In truth, she is an amazing story since she has an almost McKinsey-like approach to business, asking continual why questions until she understands the root of any issue and then initiates immediate corrective action, Stock says. Stock carved out a part of the company set up as purely a management services business using the staff already in place. This serves as sort of a second turning point when Recreation Factory Partners built a successful business in managing the types of facilities that it used to own. Recreation Factory Partners has 90 employees and about the same number of contractors who provide instructor and specialized training services. The Orange County Sportsplex now has about 5,700 members and generates around $3.7 million in revenue per year. Orange County leaders have plans for a 50,000-square-foot addition to the facility. The management model has been successful enough that Stock is in discussions to replicate the model in two other markets. Stock, who is 62, is also thinking about a transition and is in the process of changing the structure from a simple limited liability entity to an S corporation structure to facilitate added shareholders and succession. While I'd like to think I'm still vibrant, I'm likely in the last chapter of my business career, he says. And there's a little box of information, a closer look at John Stock, CEO of Recreation Factory Partners. First job, working for his dad, both as a painter and a store clerk for his paint and wallpaper business. My dad remains a role model. He treated everyone from the casual worker who dug ditches to the owner of a $1 million home we were working on with the same degree of personal regard and respect. Family. John and Brenda share three grown children and three grandchildren, all in the Triangle. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can from the Small Business Section column on family business written by James Lee, who is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. The headline, Indecision Can Keep a Company from Moving Forward. I'd spent a stimulating couple of hours with the local chapter of the Society of Financial Services Professionals, talking about some of the reasons why family businesses may resist following good professional advice. As I was stowing my laptop computer, a member of the audience, an attorney named Marilyn, handed me her card and said, "Please give me a call. One of my clients really needs to talk with you, and so do I." A couple of weeks later, the three of us sat in Marilyn's office and watched the rain fall. We'd spent the morning reviewing a detailed framework for transferring ownership and management of the client's $100 million-plus media business to his three children in the context of his overall estate plan. We'd spent the afternoon listening to the 70-something-year-old client, Jake, make excuses for doing nothing. Okay, I said to Jake, let me try one more time to understand where we are. Marilyn has produced an estate planning approach, including business ownership continuity, that meets your financial needs and conforms to your stated preferences and expectations. It covers all the necessary ownership agreements, financial projections, tax implications, even outlines trusts to be set up to receive your son's purchase payments, right? Right, Jake nodded. So why are the three of us sitting here instead of being out somewhere lifting a celebratory glass to a well-executed plan and a bright future for all concerned? It's like I said, Jake said. What Marilyn put together is what I need to do. I'm just not ready to do it yet. That's what you said last year, Jake, Marilyn reminded him. We put everything on hold and then had to redraw a lot of the plan after you sold two of your divisions. You should put these plans in gear now. They don't require any immediate action. Not so fast, okay, Jake said tersely. I'm not ready. Try this, Jake, I said. Somewhere in the back of your mind there's a fear gnawing away, a fear that once you accept this framework, everything in your life will start to change. And when it starts, you think the high ground you've stood on for so many years, success in business and respect in the community and even your self-esteem, will collapse like a hillside washing away in a flash flood. That's a price you don't think you can pay. Not even to secure the future of your business and your family. Jake looked away to the rain streaming down the window. Well, maybe it's something like that. He turned back to Marilyn and me. And we'll stop there as Jake realizes that his planning for the future and succession was actually his biggest executive challenge that he had to undertake. And actually, we will stop right there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. But be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.